This is September 28th, 2008, and this will be the second part of a topic that we began in last week's Teisho. I've given it the following title for reference purposes in our tapes of this Teisho, these two Teishos: Losses Nurtured in an Age of Distraction, Cohesion, Depth, Insight. It's a long title, but it's the book that I'm primarily reading from is a very broad-ranging treatment of these new challenges we face and the threat we are under in terms of the cohesion and depth and insight of our experience of the world. I won't have time to review last week's material except in the very briefest of ways. In fact, I'm going to just read from the dust jacket of this book. The book is called Distracted, and the subtitle is The Erosion of Attention and the Coming Dark Age. It's by Maggie Jackson. And it says here in the inside, we have oceans of information at our disposal, yet we increasingly seek knowledge in online headlines glimpsed on the run. We are networked as never before, but we connect with friends and family via email and fleeting face-to-face moments that are rescheduled and interrupted a dozen times. Despite our wondrous technologies and scientific advances, we are nurturing a culture of diffusion, fragmentation, and detachment. It goes on, in this new world, something crucial is missing: attention. The key to recapturing our ability to connect, reflect, and relax. The secret to coping with a mobile, multitasking virtual world. Distracted vividly shows how, day by day, our hypermobile, cyber-centric, interrupt-driven lives erode our capacity for deep focus and awareness. So last week, I did a lot of reading from the book just to describe, as she does, the what she calls the landscape of distraction, and how and how our experience of the world is being changed in quite a fundamental way through our new technologies. She points out that our sense of space is completely shattered by the introduction of virtual realms, that our sense of place has been reshaped, our relationship to place, by a life of perpetual movement, and that our notions of time are being completely reoriented by the simultaneity of our various forms of communication and entertainment. And she makes a very strong case, I think, a very compelling case, that there are three primary losses that we are suffering that are at least losses that are nurtured in this age of distraction. The first is trust, and she ties this a lot to surveillance. I didn't have time, and we won't have time, to get into the chapter on surveillance, but that is one of the losses that we're nurturing, trust. Second is our means and ability to go beneath the surface to think deeply. That we'll focus on more today. And the third loss is that we're narrowing our connection to ourselves and to each other, to one another. So I'm going to go now to the case she makes. This is all new material now. I'll be getting into the case she makes of how, for all of our stupendous capacity of information harvesting, it has not served us well, really, in terms of education or understanding. She introduces us, the reader, to the concept of information literacy and how it is eroding. First, she lays out some statistics. Only about a quarter of high school graduates are college ready in the four main subject areas of English, reading, math, and science. Close to half of students enter college needing remedial help, and many exit still needing remedial help. She quotes Harvard president Derek Bach as saying that almost all educators agree the main purpose of an undergraduate education is critical thinking. And she says, like its elusive sister concept, information literacy, critical thinking is defined in numerous ways. Bach describes critical thinking as habits of disciplined common sense that include reasoning, problem solving, judgment, and good research skills. She says that that most college students graduate still believing that knowledge is just a matter of opinion, in which evidence plays little role. And related to critical thinking is reflective judgment, the kind of thought needed to wrestle with ill-structured issues, such as gun control. And then she poses the question, in a land of distraction, can we become truly reflective citizens, convinced that ill-structured problems are susceptible to reasoned arguments based on evidence, not just opinion? Surely, anyone can easily make the connection between this erosion of reflective judgment or critical thinking and the outrageous abuses that we have suffered under the current administration. I still remember after 9/11, at least 2 years after 9/11, where 60% of Americans still believed that there was a direct connection between Saddam Hussein and the attack on 9/11. And then she links this to self-discipline and self-control. Self-control is a complex and fascinating concept that is central to fostering the reflective thinking skills and deep engagement in learning that are so needed, individually and collectively, in the digital age. Willpower is a part of self-regulation, or the ability to control body and mind and transform the inner animal nature into a civilized human being. She cites a study where they looked at 164 eighth graders over a school year and found that their scores on measures of self-control proved twice as predictive as IQ of their final grades. And then the connection between self-control or willpower and attentional control. Attentional control being the driver behind willpower and the means of successfully resisting gratification. And this gets us into the three networks of attention. Three different areas that are encompassed in attention. And this is becoming, these three terms are becoming widely used in neuroscience. I found at the conference I attended on the Mind and Life Summer Research Institute this past June. And they have various terms for them, but let's start by using orienting, alerting, and the executive function. Now, this is where we get directly into Zen practice. Orienting is focusing. Orienting, attention used in an orienting or focusing way is like a flashlight. I was surprised to find this used in both in this book and in the conference I went to, because this just came to me a few years ago, and I've been using it in Doksan, where our attention can be used like a flashlight. Our attention, picture yourself in a dark room, pitch black, and you flick on a flashlight, and there's that beam of light. And you can flick that beam any direction you want, up on the ceiling, over on the wall, down on the floor, on the other wall, really quite effortlessly. Just flick, boop, boop. Boop, there it is. All those different surfaces, there it is. This is how we learn to use attention. And on this matter of the use of our attention, everything rides on that. Spanish philosopher José Ortega y Gasset said, "Tell me to what you pay attention, and I'll tell you who you are." So this is orienting or focusing. We, of course, are constantly tested on our ability to flick this flashlight of attention when we find our minds pulled away again and again and again while we're sitting. We apply ourselves to, let's say, counting the breath. We start with one, maybe we get to two or three, and then before we know it, our mind is somewhere else. We notice that it's drifted off, and it may be have been quite a while that it's been roaming in all other directions. And then we have a choice. And on this choice, our practice rests. And here's the choice. Do we stay with the thought or the image? Do we stay there? Do we leave that flashlight on the thought or the image or the train of thoughts? Or do we flick it back to number one in the counting of the breath? There it is, right there, that choice. And then even if we blow it, even if we linger a while in the fantasy or thought, and then eventually bringing the mind back to the counting, then we get another chance soon after that, because the mind will have wandered again. The real problem here is that it takes place between the noticing of the thought or the fantasy, between that and just flicking it back to the breath or the koan, whatever one's practice is. That is where our karma asserts itself. That's where our conditioning causes so much mischief, because what most people do is not just returning to the practice after noticing the thought or the fantasy, but before getting back to the practice, there is, if not lingering in that little storyline or fantasy, if not choosing to linger there, then there is this intrusion of self-criticism or comparing oneself. So this is a typical tableau. We notice the mind thinking about what someone said to us in that meeting yesterday. And then we come to awareness of that. And then what way too many people do, I'm speaking from long experience myself, is, oh my God, what is wrong with you? How many times does it take you how many times do you have to go through this before you can learn to hold your damn mind on the counting? What is wrong with you? No one. All these other people sitting around me, no one could have as much trouble as I'm having. What is wrong with you anyway? And so forth and so forth. There's so many variations on this theme. But the whole problem is bringing the self, the thought of the self, in there. It's a problem because it gums everything up. We don't need to do that. Is just the noticing and the returning to the breath or the koan. That's all. No commentary is called for. It just messes everything up to go into this commentary. Now here's the additional problem, is that we may be so habituated to lapsing into the commentary that we don't notice we're doing the commentary. Does anyone have had this experience besides me? Or so you shift the flashlight. You shift the flashlight from what someone said to you yesterday, or on the phone last night. You shift that to the self, me, the I, the me, or the my. You're still not back. It's not much better at all. So. That's focus, that's orienting, or we might say reorienting in practice, is getting the mind back to what we often in Zen call no mind. No mind is this realm of mind that is beyond forms, beyond thought forms, or fantasies of any memories, plans, all of these things that the mind spends most of its waking hours doing. No mind is the realm of direct experience. No thought. So that's what each of the different Zen practices have in common. They all are ways for us to reorient to no mind. The breath, the koan. And that really is sort of the essence of meditation. It's orienting to experience, direct experience, not the thought of things, not thoughts, but experience. The physical, direct experience, the eating, the drinking, the hearing of the rain dripping on the pavement, the sound of the crow, the direct experience. And that, in a way, sums up all of meditation experience, no matter how new or advanced you are at it. It's orienting to experience, the thing itself. And we do that through the skillful use of attention. In order to flick that flashlight, we have to notice where the mind is. And that's the second aspect of attention that is brought out in this book, but also that I heard articulated in this conference, the Mind and Life Conference, and that is what could be called the awareness or wakefulness or alerting function. And this is really the harder part. It's hard enough to flick the flashlight, but even harder is to notice when the mind has drifted. Because you can't notice until you notice. You may be absorbed in this fantasy or that fantasy, this thought or that thought, for the longest time without noticing. We all know this. And there's really nothing we can do because there is no volition involved. There's no awareness until there's awareness. However, doing a daily practice of sitting is going to move us into spending less time with the mind wandering without noticing. In other words, put another way, we will more quickly notice when the mind has drifted. And that's just part of the arc of longer practice. We are up against increasing odds with all of the technologies that we went into last week's Taisho that she spends more than half of the book talking about, just to outline those a little more. Says here, kids are the inveterate multitaskers, the technologically fluent new breed that is better suited for the lightning-paced, many-threaded digital world, right? After all, they are bathed in an average of nearly 6 hours a day of non-print media content, and a quarter of that time they are using more than one screen, dial, or channel. Nearly a third of 14 to 21-year-olds juggle 5 to 8 media while doing homework. This boggles my mind. Yet for all their tech fluency, kids show less patience, skepticism, tenacity, and skill than adults in navigating the web, all while overestimating their prowess, studies show. Meanwhile, 15-year-olds in this country rank 24th out of 29 developed countries on a test, Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development test, of problem-solving skills related to analytic reasoning, the sort of skills demanded in today's workforce. Nearly 60% of 15-year-olds in our country score at or below the most basic level of problem-solving, which involves using single sources of well-defined information to solve challenges, such as plotting a route on a map. Government and other studies show that many U.S. high school students can't synthesize or assess information, express complex thoughts, or analyze arguments. Such people, of course, are enormously vulnerable to the machinations of election campaigns, the skillful use of spin and the use of equivocation in language. Back to information literacy. This was quite an eye-opener to me. Only 30% of college graduates can understand a simple document such as a food label. Wait, what? So this information literacy. Shifting attention to the vast resources of the web sounds natural, and yet faced with a tsunami of largely unsifted, unedited information, students often don't know how to separate the wheat from the chaff, nor how to thoughtfully use what they harvest. They, like so many of us, are often stuck on the veneer of the information world, grasping at the first, quote, answers that pop up from narrowly tuned search engines that in turn reveal no more than 15% of the highly commercial, poor quality surface web. Even within this tiniest tip of the information iceberg, the choicest bits, relatively speaking, are hidden because search engines such as Google run on algorithmic formulas that place irrelevant or mediocre sites on a par with expert ones. What's highly linked or paid for gets top billing, regardless of merit. Whoa. Yet what comes up first seems fine to most of us. Nearly 75% of Americans with 5 or more years of online experience say search engines are, quote, fair and unbiased. 60% don't know that there are paid and unpaid results. Study after study at top and lesser schools reveal these conclusions. Students, including seniors, display a particularly narrow field of vision in searching. They use quick and dirty ways of finishing the task, often opt for convenience over quality, and give up easily. What is perhaps most disturbing, she writes, is that so many are convinced that they are doing well, hunting and pecking through info gluts on their own. Tech-fluent people aged 18 to 29 are more confident in their abilities, yet less discerning evaluators of online information than other age groups. Today we more often skate across prose, be it on screen or printed page. We read to glean and to get the neatly packaged answer, not to be changed. We read to gather information. Most people, from workers to kids to scholars, don't go deeply enough into the search process to do much more than collect a grab bag of information morsels. They are left with a cessation of their task, not the consummation of their quest. How do we search? How do we make meaning from information? Whether we're looking for information on a diagnosis of cancer or writing a work report, uncertainty is an essential component of the process, not an unwelcome impediment to learning. In her five-step roadmap of information searching, Kultow found that people experience apprehension as they approach a research task and feel confused and unconfident as they focus on a topic or area of interest. In the third and most difficult stage, exploration, our uncertainty, doubt, and confusion increase as we dig into the dispiritedly inconsistent information pertaining to the subject. So there's this element of uncertainty that is the wellspring of true understanding. That she says we are losing through this information skimming and data gathering. She says, in honing the art of skimming across infinite texts, are we losing the hard-fought skill of delving beneath the surface? There's so much that you never really have time to dig through. You end up digging through so much useless stuff that you get tired of looking, and you end up looking somewhere else, and you never find what you started to look for. And this is where we come to the third aspect of attention, after those of the orienting or focusing or the flashlight on the one hand, and the second one, which is the awareness, wakefulness, or alerting aspect. The third is what neuroscientists are calling the executive function. The executive network is our troubleshooter, a sheriff who moonlights as the judge, with a long reach and a heady power that is, alas, easily corrupted. The modus operandi of this network, with its mastermind, the anterior cingulate, that she went into some neuroscience we don't have time for, remains a bit of a mystery. Yet without this capacity, the brain is a lawless patch of cerebral country. Executive attention is not only at the heart of self-control, but central to a spectrum of crucial capabilities from planning to metacognition, that is, understanding the workings of the mind. Encounter a snake on the trail, write your will, multitask, quit smoking. Almost all new, difficult, dangerous, or complex challenges or occurrences prompt a 911 to executive attention, whose resume, selection and control, with a specialty, whose resume touts selection and control with a specialty in conflict resolution and catching mistakes. Executive attention operates top down, meaning higher order brain regions draw on sensory data to impose a framework of interpretations and volition on our thoughts and actions. Bottom-up processing, in contrast, carries raw perceptions up a ladder of cognition from lower to higher echelons of the brain. So this is sort of the outline of the battle that we face in our contemporary world, is the top-down versus the bottom-up. Not, it's too simplistically drawn. We are always gathering sensory data the raw perceptions of sensory data that rise up. But she makes the case that we're not imposing any kind of discernment on all of this data that we're harvesting in our computers. And that's where we get into real serious trouble. So I'm going to propose an analogy here for this executive function. I already mentioned that the first one, the focusing, is like flicking that flashlight, but that itself can't be done until we have the second, that is the awareness. The third, this executive function, is the seeing through. The first two together are kind of a composite of samadhi. Noticing, returning. Samadhi, for people who are new to this, samadhi just means absorption, holding the mind steady and still on one point. That's the first two aspects of attention. But it's only half the story of Buddhist meditation. And this isn't just Zen. Tibetan Buddhism, too, all different Buddhist meditation teaches that there are two aspects to meditation. One is the quiescent, the samadhi thing, to learn to hold the mind on one thing. That's what breath practice introduces us to, this process of the mind wandering and then bringing it back. That develops concentration. But concentration is just that half of it. The other is what is called in traditional language vipassana, which is the insight aspect. And that is what I think, I don't know, at least bears a semblance to this executive function. This is the seeing into. The samadhi half is This you picture a pond of water that's all roiled up from the wind and turmoil and waves and ripples and so forth, and it's muddy and you can't see into the pond. The samadhi part, the quiescent, the awareness and focusing, this is what brings the winds to stillness and the mud settles and then allows us to see into this pond of mind, to see through forms, to see through thoughts. In practical terms, how does this relate to just our daily lives? It means discernment, being able to separate the wheat from the chaff. I can't help but thinking of the election campaign, because it's so omnipresent in the news, but what more vital tool do we need to have to be able to discern spin from the real thing, to be able to see through this often deceptive use of facts, so-called facts, and to really have a deeper understanding of it. There's a lot at stake here. If we can't exercise this executive function, this top-down use of our higher brain functions, then we are really easily manipulated and and we see what has now been going on for years and years is as citizens we have abdicated. Too many of Americans have abdicated this judgment. Judgment Judgment. Sometimes people misunderstand this word because in Zen we sometimes will use it in a pejorative way as something that is that causes us a lot of problems. When we speak about in Zen about refraining from unnecessary judgments, the emphasis is on unnecessary. And judgment in these cases means more than the assigning virtue or evil to things, or to people, more likely, is more commonly, where we pass judgments on people in the everyday business of our lives. He's bad, that's wrong, she's bad, she's wrong, these kind of things. This is very deeply entrenched in our minds. And if you don't believe so, go to Sesshin sometime. Spend 10 or more hours of sitting a day, and you will see this demon of judging other people and judging oneself in all of its ferocious power. This is a great impediment to practice, too. All right, they come up. We see them, just, they're like any other thoughts. They happen, they arise on their own, but we don't ever want to dwell in that because it is a thought and it's not the reality. But judgment can be understood in a very different way. Judgment is, I looked up in the dictionary and among other definitions, this is the one I think that our author is extolling and lamenting by its deterioration in modern people. That is the ability to come to opinions about things, the power of comparing and deciding, or simply understanding or good sense. There is nothing in Zen that has any problem with any of these things. About the opinions, those of you who have been practicing long enough know that this can also be a real troublesome thing to fall into. But again, I see it as unnecessary opinions. When you go to the voting booth on November 4th, and I hope to Buddha everyone here does, when you go to the voting booth, you're registering a kind of opinion. So it's not that opinions are bad. Sometimes we need to exercise judgment. Let's call it judgment. Opinion is too often it just means a gratuitous, uncalled for idea about someone or something that we don't need to form. These opinions usually are ways of avoiding ourselves just by fleeing into such thoughts when they're not really necessary. But this understanding, let's consider now for this teisho, let's consider judgment as understanding. And that is something that we desperately need. And it is what it is our birthright as human beings, as Homo sapiens. This is what distinguishes us from other creatures, is this ability to sift through when called for, when we're asked to, when we need to sift through things, our ability to go beneath the surface and to think deeply about things. In one portion of the book, she talks about which she calls reflective judgment, and this too, there isn't a great deal that we say about reflection in Zen practice, but for koan practice in particular, this is a useful tool. It's not to just drone on in one's mind about the koan, say the koan is mu, not to just use it as a mantra, but to peer into. People at Sesshin have heard me say this over and over again, and to quote Wittgenstein, the German philosopher, don't think, look. Look into. Look into the koan. Even question it. This is something altogether different from the first two aspects of attention, but it requires the first two aspects, the focusing and the awareness, or rather in the other order, first the awareness and then the refocusing. There are three main categories of Zen practice. There's the breath counting, and breath practice, following the breath and counting the breath. This is where the first two, the awareness and the focusing, are required, but not the third, really, the executive function. Koans that require the first two and the executive function. Shikantaza, which is the most demanding of all Zen practices, the most advanced, and which I never even attempted till I'd been practicing for 15 years, Shikantaza requires the awareness, that component, the awareness or alerting or wakefulness component, in a receptive, panoramic, non-judgmental way. This is, I think, a very useful phrase for Shikantaza, receptive, panoramic, non-judgmental awareness, where you're not focusing. Shikantaza does not involve focusing. There's no thing to focus on. There's no flashlight. It's just all light. But in all Zen practices, and whatever it is, breath, koan, Shikantaza, all of it involves noticing and a kind of metacognitive awareness. Metacognitive awareness is how we change our relationship to thinking rather than just trying to change the thinking. Do you understand the difference here? We're not trying to get into the content of the thoughts and change the content. So let's say we have some grotesque thoughts, some lascivious thoughts, some angry thoughts. We're not in meditation. We're not trying to get in there, roll up our sleeves, get under the hood, and change those things. We want to be able to step back and see that it's thoughts. The particular kind are not important. It's thoughts, and we don't want to traffic in thoughts. So we come refrain from getting involved in the content of the thought. That's really the essence of not just Zen, but other kinds of Buddhist meditation. So we have this challenge of dealing with this staggering amount of information that we're exposed to every day, many of us, maybe not everyone, but many of us, and how to manage it all, how to evaluate it all and be able to, separate the wheat from the chaff. There's a piece that was written, someone gave me, really very, very deeply insightful piece by Mark Helprin, called The Acceleration of Tranquility. The title I can't explain in the short time we have left. But he refers to the fact that potential has always been the overlord of will. That there is so much potential these days. There's so much we can monkey around with and waste our time with on screens, whether it's TV or computer screens or any other kind, computer games. And this potential can get the better of us, and we can come at the price of our exercise of will. He says that the heart of Western civilization is not the abdication of powers, but rather meeting the challenge of their use. He says it's necessary. What's required is the discipline, values, and clarity of vision that tend to flourish as we grapple with necessity and to disappear when, by our ingenuity, we float free of it. I'm going to close with a passage by Thoreau that I have read from a number of times, but it's so prescient. He was so aware of. Now this is Thoreau, you know. This is when all there were to read were books, basically. But even then, this is what he recognized as the danger. He says, "I believe that the mind can be permanently profaned by the habit of attending to trivial things, so that all our thoughts become tinged with triviality. We should treat our minds, that is ourselves, as innocent, ingenuous children whose guardians we are, and be careful what subjects we thrust on their attention. Read not the times, read the eternities. Conventionalities are at length as bad as impurities. Even the facts of science may dust the mind by their dryness unless they are, in a sense, effaced each morning, or rather rendered fertile by the dews of fresh and living truth." I would say they're fresh and living experience. "Knowledge does not come to us by details, but in flashes of light from heaven. Yes, every thought that passes through the mind helps to wear and tear it and to deepen the ruts." I realize that this whole warning, these two teishos may not make me popular with many people who have come to spend many of their waking hours with electronics mediating their direct experience, and who have come to feel This is just what you have to do nowadays. But people will of course be free to disagree. But please consider these points and try to be vigilant of what cost all of this is coming, what price we are paying for these things. All right, our time is up. We'll stop and recite the four vows.